This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome back to New Books Network. I'm Vladislav Lilic, doctoral candidate in modern European history at Vanderbilt University. In today's episode, I'm delighted to host Dr. Miriam Buck McKenna, associate professor at the Department of Social Sciences and Business at Roskilde University in Denmark. Dr. McKenna's research takes an interdisciplinary and socio-legal approach to law with a particular focus on international law, legal history, law and gender, law and political economy, and post-colonial legal theory. We will be discussing her captivating first monograph, Reckoning with Empire, Self-Determination in International Law, hot off Brill's Press. The book traces the ways in which various actors have sought to reinvent self-determination in different juridical, political, and economic iterations to create the conditions for global transformation and to challenge exclusionary practices of Eurocentric world orders. Dr. McKenna, thank you for joining New Books Network and for taking the time to talk to me about your work.
Thank you so much for having me, and thank you for that generous introduction.
As is customary on the channel, I will start us off by asking how your previous intellectual and research trajectories had led you to write Reckoning with Empire.
Yeah, well, so this started as my dissertation, which I wrote at the University of Copenhagen at the law faculty several years ago. And it was sort of, it emerged from my interest in this discussion that had begun at that point about the manners and ways in which international legal history had been written. And this sort of growing critique of how international lawyers use history and write history, and that of course being this tendency to have a quite positivistic approach and to follow many of the same focal points on hierarchies of sources that follow the international legal positive approach. The way that history is sort of used within this framework to sort of underpin certain legal and normative ideas has been increasingly criticized. And I was really interested in these discussions, and I thought that self-determination really epitomized this problem because I had come to this area during my LLM studies, which I wrote about the International Court of Justice advisory opinion on Kosovo. And I was just really interested in the incredibly varied approaches that states were taking in their submissions on self-determination. And I just didn't think that quite followed the history that I had been reading about self-determination, which is very singular and very teleological. It's incredibly sort of consistent throughout all texts on self-determination. And I thought that was somehow just too narrow and too unnuanced. So what I was really interested in doing was revisiting this history through a different lens and a less positivistic lens. And I was supervised by a sociologist, a legal sociologist, who, you know, was very worked with and was very informed by the work of Bourdieu. So I decided to take this idea of self-determination and sort of open up the conception of what self-determination could mean in social law to be sort of a far more sort of socio-legal idea, one in which there have been various contestations and frictions over defining its meaning and using it in different to pursue different ends. So I was really interested in sort of playing with this idea of rewriting international legal history in a different way, in a much more socio-legal way, and drawing on a different variety of source material, and really trying to step outside of that classical approach to writing international legal history. So that's sort of where it started. And then, I mean, to be honest, I finished in 2015 and I went on maternity leave and I put it on the shelf for a couple of years. I wasn't really that interested in pursuing the book. And, you know, through the years, several people who had been on my committee and had read the text sort of were interested in why I hadn't published it. And so towards the end of 2020, I decided, okay, this is the year I'm going to finally put it out in the world. So, yeah. And in that sort of period, a lot of things had really changed, I think. And there's been this really wonderful and fruitful discussion that's gone on, particularly in international relations and political theory. And, of course, that I'm referring to Adam Gashchew's wonderful book, which looks at you know, the use of self-determination, particularly by Pan-African political activists, and I just wanted to sort of I guess this is kind of dovetailing with a lot of this work, but much more focused on this legal iteration. And so within legal institutions and settings, how has this this idea, which is very amorphous and ambiguous, being used by different actors. So the idea is to really get away from that linear, teleological, progressive narrative, which has tended to talk about self-determination as this sort of gradual unfolding of a, you know, liberal idea, which tends to start, you know, during the Enlightenment period and then has sort of been, you know, taken up at various junctures, and then, of course, you know, becomes this right during the decolonization period. And that's just really not what I was seeing when I was looking at a lot of the debates in different legal fora and also in the writings of various academics. So I wanted to, yeah, to sort of revisit that narrative and open up to showing how self-determination is an incredibly interesting sort of a bit of a Pandora's box in the international legal system. And that's also something that I guess international lawyers that sat not, like sort of awkwardly with international lawyers over the years, because, you know, they tend to want to give it some sort of concrete definition. And so this is where the history has come in, is that they've tended to, you know, struggle with defining it in a positivist sense. So they tend to turn to, you know, different points where this is sort of maybe, you know, crystallized into certain legal documents or frameworks. But I think that misses a lot of how, you know, how politicized this idea has been and how radical an idea in the international legal order this idea actually is. I don't think we give enough credit for being this, you know, really, really interesting kind of legal phenomenon in international law, because it's sort of seen, I think, for a lot of people as a kind of a lot of lawyers at least, is this kind of annoying sort of undefinable principle, which just kind of causes a lot of problems.
Now, you cannot see me, of course, but I was nodding vigorously throughout your initial response, and this perfectly anticipates my following question. And would you elaborate on your approach to law and history? Recently, there has emerged a debate about the benefits and pitfalls of the ways in which historians use the law and international lawyers use history to narrate these transformations of global legal frameworks. How exactly does Reckoning with Empire respond to these dilemmas?
Yeah, I mean, it is trying to plug into some big debates that have been going on, particularly amongst critical international lawyers for several years now. I think I adopt that same slightly wary stance on writing history as a lawyer, because I'm not a trained historian. So I'm very aware that I'm using history in a way that is very particular to my discipline, but also doing so in a way that tries to step away from the ways in which international lawyers have tended to write history, which is, again, that like extremely positivist focused, sort of fitting an idea within a predefined narrative in a way, or a predefined idea, and sort of looking for the historical sources that kind of back that up, which is obviously really problematic for historians. And this is also why it's so incredible that so many trained historians and you know, different kinds of people from different scholarly backgrounds have come to the writing of international history, international legal history, because it really opens up, this quite problematic way of writing history. So I guess quite an institutional history. It's quite a macro history. I'm looking at these kind of broader shifts. I wish I had been able to do far more archival research and also look at a range of actors that fall outside of, traditional institutional settings. And had I had more time and sort of a bit more training, I would be able to do that. And I'm, now slowly moving into, doing more archival work in my newer projects. But this, I guess, is an attempt to utilize the same, at least normative underpinnings of this sort of turn to history trying to open up the ways we think about history, and also kind of reflecting upon how history has been used in international law. And again, as I mentioned, I think that self-determination is such a prime example of how this history has really subsumed a lot of the more radical parts of the history of self-determination.
Yeah. So you argued that self-determination highlights blind spots of international law and challenges the seeming permanency of discriminating and exclusionary practices. Would you please guide our listeners to your innovative, or through your innovative theoretical and historical understanding of self-determination as a potent discursive means that continues to be mobilized in aid of various causes?
Yeah, thank you. That was a great question. So I guess my main sort of argument through this book is really to kind of to point to the way in which self-determination, because of its very unique history in this broader sort of intellectual history, which I think resonates, not just within sort of the liberal sort of tradition, but is, spread across different political cultures and ideas, has created this sort of gap in the international legal order. And because it is this sort of amorphous principle, it's this sort of open-ended idea which really lacks definition but has this kind of incredible purchase in sort of political theory, it's sort of created this like wedge in the international system, which has allowed people to pursue different pursue different sort of political ends and projects. So I start off, of course, with the project of decolonization, which I think when you read a lot of the classical narratives of self-determination in international law, the way that self-determination was used during the decolonization period is either kind of seen as purely symbolic, and I point to this claim made by Martti Koskiniemi in a text he wrote in the early 90s about national self-determination, that it really wasn't, you know, that much of a strategic claim. It was, yeah, purely symbolic. Or that it's sort of, yeah, seen as this harnessing of this idea, you know, that really stems from the Wilsonian idea of self-determination following World War I. And I think both of those things are sort of inaccurate, because it was far more of a claim to completely unpicking a lot of ideas of unequal hierarchies and unequal integration in the international order that existed at this point. And I think at that time as well, there was this incredible sense that there could be change pursued through international institutions and international law. And there was this, at least what I'm seeing, this real, really strategic usage of the idea by different legal actors. And of course, it's pursued primarily through the setting of the human rights bodies during the negotiations of the two covenants. But I don't think it's purely a human rights claim that is being made here. It's a claim to you know, sovereignty and a certain kind of sovereignty that's made during this point in time. And I think I go back through other periods as well to sort of to show that maybe these junctures that have been written about in accounts of self-determination have also maybe missed a little bit of the nuance in how self-determination has been circulated and used at this time. So during the post-World War I or the interwar period, you know, there's, I guess, in a lot of the kind of classical narratives, there's this idea that this is the point in which, you know, it's mobilized for political aims, but it sort of fails the test of kind of emerging from a political framework to a legal framework. And actually what I want to show is that it is actually, you know, incredibly legally important at this point, you know, through the mandate system and through the minority protection schemes and through sort of early cases at the Permanent Court of International Justice, where this idea is starting to really curtail the boundaries of sovereignty and the boundaries of what states are eligible to pursue in terms of their national interests. And then, of course, in the post, not post-colonial period, but sort of the, you know, the 1970s, where the sort of height of decolonization has sort of petered out to some extent, you know, in classical narratives, that period is sort of, it's really missing. I mean, it was really strange that you would sort of read a text where it would sort of be like the interwar period, the, you know, decolonial period, and then it would suddenly pop up again in the 90s with the disintegration of the USSR. And really it was actually circulating quite prominently in the 1970s and 80s, and of course in the 1970s with the new international economic order, but also the idea of self-determination, you know, and trying to get it back to what a lot of the Western states believed was its kind of core ideals from the Wilsonian sort of political project, really popped up in a lot of debates in the 1970s regarding human rights. And it was this real shift during this period to try and, you know, get it back to this idea of, you know, democratic participation and human rights in that, you know, very classic liberal sense. And as you mentioned, sort of it's still, I still think it has enormous purchase in the international system because it is, yeah, this open-ended amorphous idea. Even though it has been, particularly in the 90s, really sort of bound up in this criticism of, you know, you know, unrelenting nationalism, and, you know, Cassisi called it a golem turned on its creators. Like, there was incredible negativity surrounding self-determination during this time. And I think somehow that's somewhat sad that it's been demonized to the extent it has. I don't think the principle in itself is problematic or bad. I think it's actually a really important sort of gap in the international legal system that's otherwise quite monolithic, and has allowed people to you know, pursue change, and really important change as well. And I think that's still happening, obviously with you know, the pursuit of Indigenous sovereignty through self-determination, and that's still ongoing. But also, I think what we're going to start seeing is a lot of these, you know, idea, these self-determination sort of colonial claims that are, you know, seen as sort of settled and a done deal are probably going to be revisited. I think, as we saw with the Chagos Islands case, I think that's probably going to be a new trend, is kind of going back and saying, well, hang on, you know, if we actually look at the sort of the period of decolonization, and there was a lot of uncertainty about, you know, the point at which it crystallized and the point at which, you know, it, what it was actually demanding of states, particularly in the 1950s, which is to this day still slightly unclear. And I think there's a lot of work to be done in this area. I think that's going to give rise to more claims in the international legal system.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Lovely. And the book's 5 chapters are chronologically ordered, and you start by diving into the Enlightenment roots of the concept, as it were. Briefly, where does self-determination come from as an international legal idea?
Yeah, so I guess I make, you know, part of this sort of intervention that I'm, you know, making, that this that self-determination has this conceptual ambiguity, and that it's, you know, provided this platform to make challenge within the international legal system, I think comes from, you know, this particular sort of longer history, which was very bound up in sort of two moves during the last, you know, 2 or 3 centuries, which is its kind of relationship to sovereignty and statehood, you know, and sort of ideas of popular sovereignty. And then this, you know, obviously this expansion of empire. And I think those two things, you know, go really, really hand in hand, and haven't really been explored in self-determination's history, because it's just, as I keep mentioning, it you know, comes from this, or this, the belief that it comes from this, you know, liberal idea in the Enlightenment and its popular sovereignty, and that's sort of, you know, this progressive unfolding stems from this point and then is taken up again, you know, particularly during the 19th century, during the push towards, you know, national statehood. And again, you know, it peaks to some extent during the interwar period. So I think what I try to do in the sort of first chapter is to sort of show how ideas of self-determination, you know, are sort of are far more embedded in, you know, ideas of sovereignty and statehood and empire that have previously been kind of seen. And then I sort of also point to, the early claims to self-determination made not explicitly in the terms, but sort of with, tapping into this sort of normative idea of popular sovereignty, particularly in, South American, claims for independence, which were made, in the mid-19th century.
Chapter 2 takes us into the interwar period and stresses how self-determination became the fulcrum of varied attempts to redefine the perimeters of imperial war orders and expand the boundaries of international society. How did self-determination help re-envision sovereignty between the world wars?
Yeah, so I think, in the 1920s and 30s in particular, you're beginning to see this institutionalization and of international law and, a lot of changes within ideas of sort of democratic practices and ideas. And what a lot of people have pointed to is self-determination, emerging at this time in attempts by various actors to articulate a new vision of world relations. And of course, I'm pointing to work by Erez Manella, people like Natasha Wheatley, Glenda Slugger, Netta Crawford, in which the normative foundations of the state are sort of beginning to shift quite dramatically. And I think these sort of early mobilizations of self-determination that are happening, obviously are, politically grounded, but they begin to, I think, open up to, both a political and normative impetus for particularly the anti-colonial lobby to frame their own claims to self-determination. Of course, this is, through, a political project. But I think what's absent from a lot of the accounts of this period is that self-determination is also really emerging as a important sort of legal principle. And that this sort of crystallization of self-determination as a kind of, legal ideal is also presenting the possibility for these same groups to pursue sort of a legal project to claim independence. And I think in a lot of accounts of self-determination, this period just tends to be seen as, it's a political a period of political mobilization, of course, by Vladimir Lenin and Woodrow Wilson, presenting two particular forms of self-determination, but that it sort of fails to make this jump because it fails to sort of emerge within the League of Nations covenant as emerging from politics to law. But what I think that kind of misses is that through particular legal institutional arrangements at this time, and particularly the minority protection regime and the mandate system, there is this emergence of self-determination as a legal idea, as something that can discipline sovereignty and can discipline certain kinds of state action. And so within this, I think this crucial legal space begins to emerge in which domestic political structures and state action are subject to international oversight, at least in theory, and that there's this new sort of internal expectation of the juridical state that is being pursued through these regimes. And so I think that it's really here that you begin to see this crucial legal space for marginalized groups who've been kept outside of international law emerging. And that this, I think, is really the origins of where the post-war decolonization move through the UN actually begins. So that's sort of what I try to point to in this chapter. And of course, I build a lot upon the work of people like Nathaniel Berman and also Karen Knopp, who have spent a lot of time in their work, or many years in their work, sort of exploring, how these periods in self-determination history have tended to be sort of erased from those grand narratives of self-determination that we tend to see in international law.
Chapters 3 and 4 then focus on self-determination as a revolutionary framework and the key battleground for struggles over hierarchies of sovereignty and international law. You show there how diverse groups of anti-colonial actors and activists from the global south wielded self-determination to challenge the existing normative and legal structures, which had rendered them unequal. How is your retelling of the story of decolonization different from other historical and theoretical accounts? And I know we've already touched on this. Mm. Maybe you can use a few examples from the text to illustrate the novelty of your argument.
Yeah. So I think, and of course, this is a period that has received a lot of attention in both international legal accounts and also in sort of political theory and IR history. And there's a lot of different takes on what actually happened during this time. Obviously, there are, I think the big sort of debate has been whether or not, self-determination and human rights were sort of, one sort of overlapping or sort of integrated project or two distinct projects. And of course, Samuel Moyne has characterized this period as sort of tending to be sort of two different projects where, people like Christian Roy Schmidt are sort of pointing to the integration of self-determination within the human rights fora, and I tend to agree with the latter, but I don't think it is as simple as simply a human rights claim. I think what happened during this time is, of course, these human rights fora and these sort of emerging frameworks of human rights provide this backdrop through which these states are beginning to launch the claim to self-determination, which they, frame in the language of rights, the right to self-determination. But that's not really all they're doing at this time, that it's far more about challenging ideas of sovereignty and statehood through this approach. And I mentioned Martti Koskinemi's claim, that it is this sort of symbolic framework of action. And he also, posits that decolonization was not accompanied by a challenge to statehood. And I just don't quite agree with that. And I think, Adam Getachew's work as well has pointed to the fact that it was actually, a whole-scale mobilization of self-determination to sort of change existing modes of sovereign authority, and move away from this exclusion of non-European peoples as unfit for sovereign rule. So it's far less symbolic and far more strategic in this period. And that's what I think I point to, that it's also, self-determination is accompanied by, these demands for non-intervention and economic self-determination at this time as well. And this is sort of trying to recalibrate, sovereign expectations and trying to rebalance the international system through self-determination. So it's not just about independence, it's about, completely changing what rights and duties they can expect in the international legal system. And I think then this becomes, the point at which, these sort of claims that are made during the 1970s in the new international economic order are originating. So I think at this time as well, things like the Goa dispute that happens in 1962, I think is a really prime example of what particular actors are seeing self-determination's normative and legal implications to be at this point. At this time with this dispute, the Indian delegates before the General Assembly are really pointing to the fact that self-determination has initiated, a change to international law. It's changed its meaning, its structure, that they're pointing to the fact that, yes, international law has been this sort of Western development, but now it's being harnessed by by states that have formerly been excluded from its ambits, and they're beginning a new project. And I think that really comes out in the debates surrounding Goa at this period. So I think this also points to the fact that this is a really interesting juncture in the potential for international law. And during the 1950s and 60s, there's far more, I think, positivity around what international law can mean for particularly colonial peoples. And it can be this platform to launch, these political projects for change. So at least in a lot of the debates that come out, there is this, this sense of, incredible radical aspiration for a new world. And this is always countered in these debates by the Western states sort of pointing to, trying to reform colonialism and trying to, pursue this idea that colonialism wasn't that bad, or could be seen as a positive development, and that's really shot down, particularly during the colonial declaration debates, quite prominently. And of course, then this is sort of countenanced by the need to reduce the possibility of continuing conflict through the application of the utipositatis principle, and this kind of tension that arises, I think, really culminates in the Biafra conflict in the 1970s and at the beginning of the 1970s, and it begins to, I think, the problems with approaching self-determination through this kind of open-ended means become more prominent at this point. But that doesn't stop, I think, these actors from trying to pursue self-determination's redefinition and use in new to pursue new political and economic projects. And of course, I'm pointing to the new international economic order. And that this is also going hand in hand with this pursuit of grounding non-interference and new forms of kind of sovereignty during this time as well. So that I think that's also kind of absent from a lot of the discussions of self-determination is that this is continues to be circulated by former colonial states, throughout the 1970s, to reframe this this international system, in their interests, and this then is countered, as I mentioned, by particularly Western states who are trying to pursue this new human rights regime, and to push back what they're considering to be, negative sovereignty, so now trying to, get back to this idea of self-determination that, comes from this liberal tradition, that guarantees sovereign or civic participation and, democracy and human rights. And this, crops up again and again in, submissions by Western states to the Human Rights Committee and in discussions of different human rights documents throughout the 70s and 80s.
Finally, Chapter 5 brings us to the end of history, as it were. You contend that self-determination has remained a crucial discursive means of resistance in these ever-changing 21st century confines of international relations. How has the concept been used in continued legal battles over the meaning of sovereignty, political legitimacy, and good governance?
Yeah, and I think what you really see in the 1990s is that the ramping up of the project towards integrating self-determination and human rights, and this emergence of this internal self-determination as trying to, I suppose, rebalance the problematic tendencies of external self-determination. And this really comes to the fore with, the discussions around the Quebec secession movement, the breakup of Yugoslavia, that somehow, sort of curbing the explosive tendencies of self-determination through human rights, through democratic ideals, is this kind of inoculation for the problems of self-determination. So it is very much, I think, now associated with this idea of self-determination. And of course, that's, you know, also given rise to certain other political projects through, for example, Indigenous sovereignty, and I suppose also a kind of expansion of minority rights through the idea of self-determination, you know, as sort of demanding a kind of an alternate form of sovereignty to counteract, you know, what is, you know, kind of a form of sovereignty that's unable to really balance all these different sub-state interests into the 21st century. And I think that's what, for a lot of international lawyers, the story has sort of ended at that point, that it's, you know, now really only about internal sovereignty, internal self-determination, and that, you know, it's going to be nigh on impossible now to really redraw borders or, you know, change, you know, states, state constellations to any degree. And I think if you look at the sort of the discourse around Kosovo as being the sui generis situation and this, you know, strange, problematic emergence that's sort of necessary to sort of back up this claim for human rights, you know, self-determination and internal self-determination, they sort of, you know, particularly Western states have to pursue the right of Kosovo to secede, because they, you know, they have to sort of put their money where their mouth is, you know, if they're pursuing this idea of, you know, demands on states to guarantee certain rights. And when this fails, you know, they sort of, you know, yeah, are kind of forced into a corner to some extent. But I think, you know, the idea that this has sort of resolved the problems of self-determination, or, you know, now we're sort of at a point where it's more clarified or well-defined, I think is not really the case. And I end the book by talking about the Chagos Islands case, which, yeah, is going back to, you know, what happened with the independence of Mauritius in 1960, and pointing to all these irregularities. And, yeah, I think this is going to continue to be a topic for debate and discussion for the coming decades.
So self-determination stays with us in all its
absolutely
destructive and constructive might.
Yeah, I mean, of course, you can point to what's been happening with the Russian claims in Ukraine, which is obviously a prime example of how this discourse of self-determination continues to be pursued. You know, and they point to what they see as the kind of hypocrisy of the West in regard to Kosovo. So I think this is absolutely not, like, it's not being put to bed by any stretch of the imagination whatsoever.
And where has this project taken you, Dr. McKenna? What are you currently working on?
Yeah, so I guess I, you know, really had thought, like, this is my sort of swan song when it comes to self-determination. But to be honest, I am really interested in particularly this period in the 1950s. And I think looking back at some of the kind of decolonization processes that, yeah, were maybe problematic or, you know, actually not carried out to their fullest. And what I've been thinking a lot about is the case of Greenland, where, you know, because obviously I'm living and working in Denmark, I think Greenland's integration into Denmark, you know, was a kind of a, you know, in the 1950s was kind of a case of how, you know, the political will of states was able to kind of maybe manipulate the decolonization process to their interests. And I'm, you know, there is now such a you know, strong claim for decolonization it's emerging in Greenland. And I'm really wondering if we shouldn't go back to what happened in the period at which Greenland was integrated into Denmark, and, you know, revisit the fact that no plebiscite was held, that, you know, the process was, you know, there was incorrect information that was given to the UN by the Danish state, that, you know, one of Denmark's sort of leading international lawyers, Alf Ross, you know, had written a memo to the Danish government saying this is not kosher, but that was dismissed. And I wonder if there is maybe a reason to go back and have a look at this period and have a look in the archives. So that's what I'm thinking that I want to do, what I'm working on at the moment.
Fascinating. Dr. McKenna, it has been a pleasure hosting you. Thank you for coming on to talk to us about your fascinating work.
Well, thank you very much for having me and letting me talk to you about my book. It's been a pleasure.